Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I truly, I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds Podcast with Danny V.
So the last 7 days has shown a number of people on social media give the podcast a little bit of love. So a big shout out and thank you to you. At 6 minutes for me, sent me a lovely message saying how much they loved the episode with Bram Presser, as well as Helen Scheurer, John Purcell, and Sarah from Booktopia podcast. Bumping into people, fellow podcasters who are also listeners, has been wonderful. The interesting places that have been listening to the podcast these last 7 days, we have Jersey City, US, Don Vale in Australia, and Everett, US. So hi to those places. And looking at countries, it always blows my mind that people are listening to this podcast internationally. And in the top 10 these last 7 days, we have listeners from France, Germany, Sweden, India, Brazil, New Zealand, and Netherlands. Thank you, Dutch relatives. Thank you for listening. Today on the podcast, episode 78, I am fortunate enough to welcome Elliot Perlman for the second time on the podcast, this time talking about his novel $3. $3 won the Age Book of the Year Award, the Betty Trask Award in the UK, the Fellowship of Australian Writers Book of the Year Award, and was shortlisted for the John Llewellyn Rees Mail on Sunday Book of the Year Award, as well as the Miles Franklin Award. He co-wrote the screenplay for the film $3, which received the Australian Films Critics Circle Award for Best Adapted Screenplay, as well as the AFI Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. Really hope you enjoy this episode with Elliot on $3.
Welcome, Elliot, and thank you again for spending time with me on the podcast. This is your second time as a guest, and this time we're talking about your novel $3, first published in 1998.
It's my pleasure, Danny. Thanks for having me back.
I think we'll start delving straight into context, because I think the context of the novel is a real driving force that underpins the entire novel. It is both a catalyst for action and in some ways inaction, and shapes the characters and how they respond to the world. I guess what I'd like you to explain is your perspective, your understanding of the concerns of this time period, the 80s and 90s, where there was quite significant change, especially when it comes to economy and then the altering of values of individuals.
Thanks, Danny. I would like to start there if I can. It's let me go way back. I think, to a large extent, writers obviously have a choice about what they write about, their subject matter, but to a certain extent you're shaped by the times in which you live, and that obviously is something over which we have no control. And I was born at a time where I saw it at the time, and it became more obvious to me because I was only in high school when it was happening, but there were two revolutions in the world, basically. Two kinds of extremism, but both extremisms came into our consciousness and flourished increasingly over the subsequent decades in around 1979-1980, and they were religious extremism and a kind of religious fundamentalism and economic fundamentalism. And I can explain what I mean by that. The explosion of religious fundamentalism meeting political power came in Iran in about 1979, and there flourished religious extremism in various branches of Islam, and then Christianity and Judaism, and pretty much every religion had some part of it that had become extreme. And then in terms of economics, there was another kind of explosion of extremism, and that was neoliberal or economic rationalist extremism or fundamentalism. That's the age I grew up in. And in Australia, at least at that time, and probably really at all times, the religious extremism has been quite muted, and it hasn't really affected our society all that much. But the other kind of extremism, the extremism of neoliberal economics, totally reshaped our society. And a lot of people have an understanding to a certain extent of what I would call neoliberalism or economic rationalism, but they perhaps would be hard put to define it. So what I'm talking about when I talk about a neoliberal revolution was a fetishization of that place where demand and supply meet, that is the market. And society was replaced as a concept by the economy. And the economy meant the market. The notion of working people banding together to improve or just maintain their wages and conditions was seen as an impediment, a distortion of the market. So what I mean is there was a prevailing view which had existed before, but it completely vanquished the opposing view. And the opposing view was what might be called Keynesian economics, which is a view that there should be a mixed economy. Some economic decisions should be determined by the market, namely where demand and supply for something meets, but the other decisions should be guided by the hand of government based on the assumption that the government has the interests of us all in mind because we vote for them. And so there might be certain things that would benefit the market but wouldn't benefit the country, wouldn't benefit society, wouldn't benefit most people. And that's where the government would step in and intervene and make certain decisions. You know, a classic example would be the provision of government schools, the provision of money to hospitals, schools, roads, tertiary education, because society as a whole said, you know what, these are good things, we need to provide them, even if people can't afford them. We don't want children suffering because they come from a family where their parents don't have a lot of money. And this kind of mixing of the private and the public was called a mixed economy, and that's essentially what Keynesian economics was about. But around about the late 70s, early 80s, with the election in the United States of Ronald Reagan and in the UK of Margaret Thatcher, Keynesianism basically lost the match. And they didn't just lose the match, they lost the season. And they didn't just lose the season, they were relegated as in the battleground of ideas. Keynesianism was completely vanquished by neoliberalism. And this was the idea that all decisions, not just economic ones, but social ones, should be determined by apparent market efficiency. So if you can make money out of it, we do it. If you can't make money out of it, you don't do it, even if society needs it. And it even changed the sort of language of political discourse, namely, people stopped talking about society. Margaret Thatcher famously said, there is no such thing as society, there was just an economy. And what this meant, this led to pressure, political pressure on both political parties, the mainstream party in Australia, the Liberal Coalition, and the Labor Party too, veered away from Keynesian economics and started to embrace, with different strengths, obviously the conservative side of politics embraced it more wholeheartedly, but the Labor Party followed to a large extent, adopting this view that we should only do what the market tells us to do. And in a sense, we all became a slave of the market. So real wages decreased and working conditions worsened because the market said, you know what, these people will probably keep working even if we pay them less in real terms, or, you know, unemployment can increase and underemployment will skyrocket as jobs went offshore to other countries and they never returned. So you started to get a massive increase in unemployment, but an even greater increase in underemployment. And underemployment is that kind of employment where you do technically have a job, but maybe you're only working a couple of hours a week. So you're barely earning anything, but technically, in terms of how the government records what you're doing, you are employed. You have a job, but it's not a job that you can really live off. It's not a job that will keep you away from economic problems. And, you know, you're going to be flirting with poverty and all the attendant social problems and domestic problems that will flow from this. And these jobs never came back. And because of the statistical sleight of hand by calling underemployed people still employed, you didn't have the political insurrection that would have flowed if suddenly 20% of the population didn't have a job, because many of these people had a job. They just didn't have enough hours to really satisfy what we used to regard as full-time employment. And I was I was acutely aware of this because I was about to leave school. And I, when there was a recession, you thought, hey, that's going to be me in a year or two. I'm going to struggle to get a job, even though I wanted to go to university. But if I didn't do well enough, I couldn't get into the course I wanted to get into. Or even if I did do well enough and I got through the course successfully, maybe there won't be a job for me when I get out. And you would see these changes in society, in politics, and in economics. Public services were privatized. Tax for corporations and for the wealthy were minimized under the spurious logic that the wealth would trickle down. So if we let corporations and the very wealthy make almost unlimited profits, eventually the people below them in on the economic totem pole, on the economic ladder, will get some benefits. But that didn't really happen. And the social safety net was torn. People were encouraged to believe that if you didn't have a job or if you weren't earning enough money, it was your fault. It was a time for people to be either winners or losers. And whichever you were, you deserved it. That's what was sold to the public. And this had its concomitant effects on mental health, as depression, anxiety, loneliness, and other social problems swept through the country like silent epidemics. And this was the beginning of the rise of economic inequality throughout the Western world that has taken us to where we are now, trying to stem the tide of one or other variant of something that looks really quite a lot like fascism. And you can see this in different ways throughout the world. Every country has its own specific cocktail of this. But here in Australia, you can see an increase in inequality that is perhaps greatest. The inequality, the difference between the wealthiest and the poorest, is perhaps currently greater than it has been at any time in the last 100 years, almost 100 years. And when that happens, people are rife. They're a lot of people are prone to look for scapegoats. And if you have angry populists calling for certain groups to be blamed or to be scapegoated, much of the rest of society is in such pain that they are looking for someone to blame. And it's the political and economic equivalent of somebody having jammed their finger in the door. And so they've jammed their finger in the car door and they're screaming in incredible pain. And if while you're in that incredible pain, I turn to you and say, he did it. She did it. They're the people that have caused your pain, the pain you're in now. Can I get rid of them? Can I stop them coming in? Can I put all sorts of restrictions on them? You're in such pain, you'll scream, yeah, what the hell, do anything. And you are not at your most reasonable, and you are not at your most generous, and you are not at your kindest because you are in such pain. And it's in this, I was aware that there was always the potential for this to happen if we allowed a rise in inequality that, in my view, and I'd already studied a little bit of economics and a little bit of history, even at the level of high school, I thought, you know, I've seen this happen before. If you study, modern European history and you look at what happened in Europe after the First World War, I should say, and the collapse of the economy and the collapse of the Weimar Republic in Germany, and then you see people are so desperate, they're ready to punish the mainstream parties that haven't looked after them and to vote for somebody that previously would have been considered a clown, but now they would vote for them almost to punish the mainstream parties that turned their backs on them. And this is being repeated to a certain extent, to a greater or lesser extent, all around the world right now. And I could see it, and I think I was particularly sensitive to it because of my background. I'm Jewish, and my grandparents came to Australia before the Second World War. They came from Poland and from Russia in the late 1920s, and they suffered economic discrimination in that they were not permitted to be civil servants. They weren't permitted to have government jobs. There was a quota on Jews going to university. There was this, I was going to say low level, but it's not so low, level of hostility and prejudice, namely anti-Semitism, directed at them and all of their families, that would periodically explode in orgies of violence known as pogroms, where Jews would be rounded up and attacked, killed, butchered. And it happened with such frequency, and even when it wasn't happening, there was a level of hostility directed to them. Even if they were completely assimilated, some of them lived in, for example, Warsaw, and they weren't necessarily religious people. They were members of Polish society, but they felt this dislike, this prejudice. And so it led to my grandparents coming out here in the late 1920s. And then, of course, we know what happened in the 30s. Some 10 or so years later, Second World War broke out, and then they lost all of their families, their brothers and sisters, parents, cousins, aunts and uncles, everybody. And had my grandparents not come out here, we wouldn't be talking now. It meant that I was brought up knowing that economic conditions and the fluctuation in economic conditions and the rise of inequality can fuel irrationality and prejudice and hatred. And so I was very sensitive to this and also to economics generally, just because I was coming of age and had to think about the job market. And so I probably had a sensitivity to this that was greater than many of my contemporaries, my friends. By the time I got through university, and I did 2 degrees, which probably only increased my sensitivity to what was going on in the world, the first degree particularly, that was a double major in economics and politics and a sub-major in economic history. And then I did law. And so by the time we get to the mid-90s, I was working at that time as an associate to a Supreme Court judge in Victoria. I had already graduated. I was a lawyer. I practiced for a little while as a solicitor. And I was working as an associate to a Supreme Court judge. And it was one Saturday morning. I, you know, wasn't working, obviously. And I went down to the local supermarket. And in that supermarket, I thought I saw the adult version of a little girl that I'd been friends with at school. And I thought, I wonder if that's her. Should I go up and say hello to her? And I caught a glance at my reflection in the dairy cabinet of the supermarket. And I thought, you know what? I'm in a T-shirt and I'm unshaven. And she, apart from being very attractive, she was immaculately groomed. She looked as though life had gone really well for her. And she looked as though probably her husband was double parked outside the supermarket in a lovely Range Rover with two gorgeous children strapped into woolly car seats in the back seat, and they've just stopped off at the supermarket before they rush off to the snow for a weekend of upper middle class fun and frolic. And I thought, you know what? I won't say hello to her. How about that? And then I thought, look, I'm not even sure it's her. Probably it is her, but no. And I kept going with the pathetic groceries of a single man, some milk, a stick of celery, Cocoa Pops, you know, something like that. And I got to the front of the supermarket queue, and I gave my credit card to pay for it. And the checkout young woman, you slid my card through the scanner, and it didn't seem to work. It didn't work. And she did it a few times, and it still didn't work. And she said, I'm sorry, sir, your card's not working. And I didn't have any cash on me. And I thought, well, look, there has to be a problem with the supermarket's computer, the scanner, because I have a job and I haven't bought very much. I can definitely pay for these groceries. And I asked her to do it a few more times. And, of course, all the other aisles beside me in the supermarket were moving very fluidly the way they're meant to. And remember, this is a supermarket. This is where our demand for goods like milk and cheese and Cocoa Pops is meant to meet the supply of, you know, milk and cheese, and that's what we're there for. And if you can't pay for your groceries, you shouldn't be there. And that's the sort of unwritten rule of the supermarket. And by now, people are starting to look at our aisle, the aisle that I'm in, that I'm at the front of, and they're starting to look and see, why isn't this aisle moving? What has he done? Was he rude to the checkout girl? Did he try and steal something? Has she caught him stealing? Why? What's the problem? What's the problem at the front of that aisle? And, of course, who is two people behind me? The incredibly attractive, immaculately groomed young woman who might or might not be the adult version of my old school friend. And I thought, this is really embarrassing. This is really humiliating. Checkout girl said, I'm sorry, sir, but I can't let you take those groceries. So I took my card and my metaphoric tail between my legs and went out to the nearest ATM machine, thinking, well, this supermarket has got to have a problem with its computer. How inefficient of the supermarket not to actually be a supermarket. And then I punched in my PIN number and it spat out the receipt. You have $3. And I thought, okay, what am I going to do? Fortunately, I had enough petrol to get home, and I drove my car back home, and I thought, there are two things you can do with this information. You can hide in a fetal position under your bed until Monday, when it's time to go back to work and earn more money, or you can use this if you're an aspiring writer, because this situation is so rich. I know, you know, economically it's poor in that I had $3, which isn't much, but in terms of storytelling, it is so rich, because it's rich in the economic problems, but it's also economic humiliation, but it's also rich in the social humiliation and the psychosexual humiliation. I mean, this, I was a single man, and society expects me to go out there, and particularly this society, and it's only got worse since the mid-90s, that, you know, essentially you are what you earn. That was the prevailing ethos of the society we live in, I think, since the 80s, that your values don't matter so much. What really matters is how fast you can, how often you can change your car, and now your phone, and how often you renovate your house or buy and sell houses. And these material measures are all you are. And if you can't live up to them, you will just fall away. You don't matter. What you do for other people doesn't matter. I thought, okay, I've got to use this. This is because this is a, what happens to people? I had a job, fortunately. So what had happened was that, you know, I was between pay packets, which isn't good. I didn't have much of a buffer, but at least I knew, well, there will be some more money coming in, I guess, within a week. So I won't starve. But what happens to people who lose their job, or to people who have children, or people who have to help support their families, their parents? And I sat down and I wrote the opening lines to the novel, which didn't really change, which is, every 9.5 years I see Amanda. Most recently was today, I had $3. It's longer than that. But that's really what set me off on my way. I thought, this is the opportunity to tell the story of the times we're living in, and to make a point through a very good man. And I had this experience promoting the book around Australia, and you go to writers' festivals, which are predominantly frequented by middle-class women, usually. Not only, but they're not all middle-class, and they're not all women, but, you know, the core audience would be middle-class or even upper-middle-class women who wouldn't necessarily vote the way I would want them to vote, but they were saying really kind things about the novel, about $3, and in large part because they liked Eddie so much. And the point I was trying to make is, they were telling me, you know, Eddie is, I'd like my son to be like Eddie. I'd like to marry a man like Eddie. I'd like my daughter to marry a man like Eddie. I would like, when my children go and play at their friend's house, I would like their friend's father to be a man like Eddie. Because, you know, he's going to do the right thing. He's going to look after people. He cares about all of us. And I was trying to say, you know what governments and corporations are doing to the Eddies out there? This is what they're doing. And when they do that to him, this is what happens to his wife. This is what happens to his family. And if it happens to enough families, look what's happening to society. It starts with the family, starts with the couple, perhaps, then the family, then the neighborhood, and then the city, society generally.
That was an incredible conclusion to what you were saying about all the things that have made that novel. And, you know, I'm sorry about your humiliation in the supermarket, but look, without it, we may not have.
Many humiliations since.
we may not have $3, but, you know, as you were saying that, and I thought, you know, like you said, the people in the audience may not be voting the way that you would like them to vote. It's interesting that the power of literature can get them to hopefully think in different ways, isn't it? Because what you were talking about, I mean, you said so much, I'm not going to be able to cover it all, but that opposing view, that silenced opposing view, and even when I listened to your afterword in the audiobook for Seven Types of Ambiguity, you said you saw some of the best minds swallow all of this unquestioningly. And yeah. I was thinking, why? You know, because people, you know, like you, like me, like those women who like Eddie, they don't agree with all these kind of ideologies, and yet we're somehow swept away by that.
Well, you know, the thing I came to realise when I was writing Seven Types and it occurred to me, I only wrote the afterword for the audiobook of Seven Types of Ambiguity about a little over a year ago, mm-hmm. and it occurred to me how much of the tension between Simon and Anna in that novel is not just romantic, mm-hmm. but it's ideological.
Yeah,
it's because he is the idealist, the romantic, and she is pragmatic, and he's furious with her for, it seems like, selling out. Mm-hmm. Now, in the case of $3, Eddie and Tanya share the same views, but they feel that they are becoming victims. But one of the things I wanted to talk about in $3 was the sense that people we could really like, you know, that are well-meaning and engaged with their community and engaged with society, they're getting hurt. You know, they're I mean, not just there. I mean, everybody, except maybe the tiny 1%, they're getting hurt by these by the rapid rise of inequality. What I get to in $3 is another epidemic, and that was depression. And I'm not naive enough to suggest that all mental illness by any means is connected to the economy, but in ways that don't often get discussed, much mental illness is connected to the economy. And at first, when one first hears that, you might think, oh, you know, how could that possibly be? And it would come about because, to a greater or lesser extent, people are aware that their jobs are under threat, or that they're being tyrannized by a particular boss. They can't afford to leave easily because we've long since gone past the days where you had a job for life, and if you didn't like it, you'd leave. And you know, my father, who's in his 80s, tells me how it used to be in the 60s, where if you didn't like your job, you'd leave in the morning and have another one in the afternoon. It would be just as good. And for us, we can't imagine such a society. And all of this has come around in large part through person-made economic decisions. That is, it's not a law of nature like the law of gravity. Things fall down, not up, and there's nothing we can do about that. Well, all of these changes that I've described as part of the neoliberal revolution were all decisions made by humans, and we all followed it. And to an extent, we couldn't even vote against it because the other side of politics was just a pale imitation of it anyway. Mm. And both sides of politics would preen before elections like peacocks, advertising themselves with promises to do less. We will spend less. We will build fewer roads and hospitals and schools. We will pay teachers less. In Victoria, you know, the economic miracle was supposed to be the retrenching, the sacking of thousands of teachers in the 90s. And this was the environment in which I was writing about $3, and my prognostications through Tanya of the kind of world we're living in now, where we're, you know, trying to stave off the lapping waves of fascism, people thought that was ridiculous. People thought I was being, catastrophizing. And I didn't think so, because history suggested otherwise. And the only thing that was surprising was how long it's taken us to get here. And that's about 40 years. And people can, to some extent, be anesthetized with gadgets and social media and computers and phones. And so you don't quite realize what's happening until you find that social media is now a weapon in and of itself,
mm-hmm.
to propagate voices of hate, or even just on a smaller scale to promote bullying, not just for children, but for adults as well.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I was going to talk to you about social media, because I think it's so easy to be drawn into someone else's ideology through mainstream media if we're not critical enough. And I think with social media, it really depends on who you're following. For example, you know, I find that the people that I follow or follow me, they do sort of try and push back against these dominant ideologies. But obviously that's not everyone's Twitter feeds, depending on your kind of political slant as well. And then I thought, well, social media could be a good thing, but then you've got the concern of just being drowned out by the masses. And so with all these things against us, how do we push back? I mean, literature's one way, but it's only one way. And how do we push back against these dominant ideologies? And I felt Eddie explored a different way of living a purposeful life. You know, you don't have to be like Paul. You don't have to have all these grand possessions. You know, you can have a purposeful and meaningful life and be like Eddie and Tanya. How do we stop that voice from being silent?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is keep yourself healthy, which includes mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways you can fight back against this kind of social pressure to be apparently, and I say apparently because it's often not even genuine, but apparently economically successful with ever newer and bigger and better cars and phones and material items, is by connecting with people around you. Because frankly, it doesn't matter how shiny your car is or how new it is. If you don't have connections with people, with your family, with your friends, talking to people near where you work or study, having these relationships can so nourish, so fuel your sense of yourself and where you are in society. It's the isolation of social media is one of the things that's so negative. If we, the human connection is essentially our biggest asset. Real connections with people that you see and speak to, The more stable you'll feel, the more connected to society you'll feel. If you can get yourself feeling that kind of strength, you're in a position to fend off these socially harmful messages.
And it's another reason why we think this book would be so good for young people to talk about, because it is about the economy, it is about that context that you were telling us about in detail, but it's also about the human connections. It's also about humanity and how we can be better and be different. And we talked about this when we talked about your children's book, The Adventures of Catwinkle, how we've got to start with young people, because they're the ones who are going to inherit the next generation and hopefully do better.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, one of the things I really wanted to try to achieve in $3, to a certain extent in all my books, is a marriage of the personal and the political, and to make the point that politics and economics will seep in under your front door, and it will start to, like a virus, attack a marriage, a relationship. It'll get to your children. It'll affect how you interact with each other on the inside of your front door. People have to realize that it's not just sort of, well, oh, there's some article in the newspaper I don't really want to read. Apparently it affects me, I can't feel it. It does affect you, and you need to be aware of this and insist that political parties pay attention to you.
Now, obviously, your work has resonated with many people, and, you know, I don't have to tell you, I've been a long-time reader of your work, but I think that's because at the heart of your writing, it really has a social conscience that underpins every character and action and response. And I know I don't have to ask you whether this is a driving force for when you write. But I found it so, I always find it so interesting that you're such a great observer of the human condition and how this resonates with people. I mean, does this come from your personal values? Does this come from your past life almost as a barrister? Does this come from your history with your grandparents? Or is it kind of a culmination of all of those things that make your writing the way it is?
Firstly, thank you so much. It's lovely of you to say that. There are certain things people, you almost can't choose what kind of writer you're going to be and what message are people trying to give you and what's really beneath that message. And that's that plus all of the socio-political stuff that we've talked about and the, you know, the anti-racism, anti-bullying side of things. Those are the things that have fueled my, or found their way certainly into probably all of my books.
Eddie says, my wife was trying to save the world, as you know, we've been talking about largely in this podcast.
Yeah.
And he says, this was the eloquence and the intolerance of unfairness I wanted Abby, his daughter, to inherit. And I just think, doesn't that just, that tiny quote just sum up everything about what we've been saying?
Yeah, well, you want to pass it on to your children and make them intolerant of intolerance and to strive to make the world a better place.
Now, going right back to the beginning of the novel, in fact, before it begins, I'm a huge Arthur Miller fan, especially Death of a Salesman. I think that play is just such a remarkable piece of work and says so much about the time in which it was written. It begins and opens with the quote, "A man is not a piece of fruit. You can't eat the orange and throw the peel away." Now, $3 and Death of a Salesman share very similar concerns. When did you find this quote for this book? Was it at the very beginning of the writing process and you were in some ways trying to echo the concerns from a different perspective, or was it through the writing process that you found? I'm trying to figure out, because it could be seen as an appropriation of Death of a Salesman. So I was wondering, at what point did that sort of come into play?
I can't remember precisely when I decided to use that quote, and I slightly rejumbled the order there, as an epigram, but
mm-hmm.
At what stage of the making of the writing of and editing of $3 I chose that. But I grew up on Arthur Miller. My parents fed him to me. He was incredibly important to me as an adolescent, his plays, and it developed in me an interest that I still have, actually, in theatre. This isn't really relevant, but I got to meet him when I lived in New York not long before he died.
And that's,
I got
definitely relevant.
No, $3 was well and truly out by then, but I got the chance to tell him how important he had been to me, and not just the famous plays, you know, Death of a Salesman, mm-hmm. The Crucible, A View from the Bridge, All My Sons, you know, these are magnificent, but also some of the lesser known plays like The Price. After the fall, my stepmother managed to find somewhere, and I still don't know how she did this, when I was 16, for my 16th birthday, she and my father gave me, and this is showing my age, a vinyl recording of the original Lincoln Center cast of After the Fall. This was a play that Arthur Miller wrote, the first play he wrote after the death of Marilyn Monroe. It led to much of America turning on him. It signified to me such a fantastic marriage of the personal and the political. It had a huge effect on me as a writer. Which is a long-winded way of not exactly answering your question. But, yeah, there's no question that Arthur Miller was a huge, and remains a huge influence on me. I have used literature all my life, or certainly since adolescence, as a kind of I self-medicate with literature. I feel I use it to make myself feel better and to entertain myself and also to teach me how to be a better writer.
and a better human.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so.
That's what I'm trying to do as a teacher. But I think that it is certainly an echo of Death of a Salesman, because it's interesting because the time period is different, but the sense of despair is the same. And it alludes to this repetitive nature of these issues that we continually put ourselves through as human beings. It's insane.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And it's interesting, you know, you've really hit upon what I think is an important point, that it is cyclical. Arthur Miller came from a family that lost everything in the Depression. And it shaped him. He became the person and the writer that he was because of what happened to his family during the Depression. The times in which he lived affected and shaped him, and the times I lived in, where after the Depression and the Second World War, we had this period of Keynesianism where things were relatively safe and calm, at least economically, and you could be fairly confident in a place like Australia that your kids would be better off than you were, that you were better off than your parents were, and this would just keep going. This can definitely not be said anymore.
Mm. Now, I do want to talk about your writing process. I thought it was important, especially not only for lovers of literature, but students who might be studying this, they do need to look at, you know, construction and writing process. Now, you've mentored some of my students, and something that stayed with them, they still mention it, and me, is the idea of continually working towards the writer you wish to be. And I think you drew this kind of little line that said, you know, you want to be this person, you know, whoever your literary hero might be, Dickens or Wilde or Miller, but you feel like you're so far away from that. And what I really liked about what you said about your process is that you just keep inching your way forward and forward and forward and forward until you get as close as you can. And I wanted you to talk about your writing process and how it's changed over the years.
Ah, that's interesting, how it's changed over the years.
And maybe you don't know the answer to that question.
Well, to a certain extent, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how much it has changed over the years. The novel I've just completed, which will be out, all going well, in October of this year, is called Maybe the Horse Will Talk. And it's probably the most overtly humorous novel I've written to date. I'd like to think there's a lot of humour in $3 as well, but this one probably has even more. And it's perhaps more tightly plotted than $3 was. Mm-hmm. And probably has I've reined myself in, which will please some people perhaps, in that I have have characters go off on tangents less often, and if they ever do go off on a tangent, I rein them in pretty quickly. So there aren't, you know, for example, Seven Types of Ambiguity, characters have discussions of certain things, which will, I think, tells you more about who they are as characters, mm-hmm. but it's a momentary break from advancing the plot. And I do that less in this novel, Maybe the Horse Will Talk, which is, you know, has more of the pacing of a thriller or a crime novel. But I've tried to have that pacing in The Street Sweeper as well. So, look, perhaps I've become a bit more, since $3, maybe I've become more interested in the pace of plot and information release. You know, for people that are not aspiring writers, that concept might never have occurred to them. But, you know, the writer has to think about, well, when do I want the reader to know something? And do I want to hint at it, or, you know, do I want to just tell them so they go from a position of not knowing this fact at all and then they know it, you know, completely with certainty, or do I want to hint at it and then confirm it a bit later? Or do I just want to sort of drop it in there casually, or do I want to make a big point of it? And so there is, you know, a question of the rate of information release that I think a novelist or even a short story writer has to has to give their attention to, turn their mind to, and I've probably become more concerned about it than I was in $3. When I started writing $3, it was my first novel, and I hadn't, you know, by definition, written a novel before, and I was terrified. I thought, I've got so much to say. And it's a little bit like you've gone for a swim and you pushed yourself off from one end of the swimming pool, and you did it with sort of great excitement and fervour, and you've got yourself, you know, 40, 50%, even 60% of the way there, and you're thinking, uh-oh, I don't know if I can get to the end, and I've lost some of the excitement because I'm plagued by self-doubt that you're hoping that the things you thought were funny are funny. You're hoping the things you thought were dramatic are, in fact, dramatic. And perhaps over the years I've got a little bit more, not much more, but a little bit more confident in trusting my first instincts.
And you've become more humorous, I hear.
Well, I'll let other people be the judge of that.
I was going to ask you about the dark humour in it, because I thought, you know, Eddie was very humorous. And
good.
And I thought, you know, is this dark humour? I'm a huge fan of dark humour. I actually read an article the other day that said if you like dark humour, you're really intelligent. So I was like, I'm going to go with that.
Yep, let's take that.
Obviously, it comes from you as the writer, but I thought, is this really Eddie living in these grim and pitiless times and his humour emerging from that time? And, you know, obviously you grew up in that time as well, so I'm wondering where that dark humour comes from. But I did enjoy it. I thought it was great.
I'm really pleased you say that, because for all that it deals with these dark subjects, I've tried to get the characters, particularly Eddie, to use humour. And I think it's really a useful tool for all of us. It helps us get through. It helps people get through the darkest times. And it doesn't mean you're not taking things seriously, but, you know, you're trying to see the funny side of it. And it can be so cathartic and consoling.
This conversation has been so rich for people who like your work or who want to read the book, and for students who are going to be studying it. But I just think, Tanya, we haven't talked about her a lot, but she just sums up things so eloquently. And we were talking about beforehand that it was, you know, very predictive of the future. And I just love this quote that she says, and I think it just sums everything up so beautifully. She says, "If we are to avoid the laissez-faire chaos we are rushing into, the polarization into the very wealthy and the very poor, the risk of complete social breakdown and the complete emergence from that wreckage of an oppressive and brutal neo-fascist regime, government policies need to be driven by a compassionate concern for the welfare of all people." It's just, it sums up everything we've been talking about.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, Tanya is a character very dear to my heart. She fights depression. She's very intelligent, and she is a victim of the time she's living in. These situations are frequently not our fault. Part of the cruelty of the neoliberal ideology is to isolate all of us and to make us think, everyone's doing well except you. Mm. You're a loser. You've got a crappy job or no job, or you only work a couple of hours a week. You can't afford a new phone. You can't afford it. Everyone else can. What's wrong with you? You're failing. The system's not failing. It's just you. Now, if that argument is made person after person after person, it's the system. I had the experience of a mother telling me that her adult son's marriage, he lost his job. His marriage had fallen apart, and he'd come home and he was living with his mother. I'm not sure where the dad was, but it was just the mother and the son living together again. And he was struggling with depression. And they started, I don't know how it started, night after night, she would read him extracts of $3 the way she would read him stories when he was a little boy.
I love this so much.
She told me that it was working. It was making him feel better. I don't mean that he had debilitating depression and that, you know, all he needed to do was read $3 and he'd be perfectly well again, but it was helping him. And I thanked her for telling me that, and I said, please tell your son it's not him. It's not his fault. It can happen to anyone, we need to stick together and remind each other that people are important and we can change things. It's in our hands if we stick together and fight for social, economic and political change.
There are so many things that I love about that story, not only him not feeling alone because he's being read to, but that almost, that vulnerability of bringing you back to childhood and your mother reading you that book. And I just love that story so much.
I wanted to give that man his dignity back.
It's a beautiful story as a mother myself too, you know, and you don't want to see your children befall these kind of things. But like you said, it's beyond our control and it's not us. And hearing other people's stories, I think, is very helpful. Something I wanted to just touch on with Tanya was that she fights depression in an age where depression wasn't entirely understood and there were still some stigmas around it. So I'm glad that has changed.
Yeah, well, fortunately, that is one area in which I think we're making progress, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. more and more people are talking about it. And it's being recognised, for the social problem it is, not simply the personal problem it is. And it enables more people to get help, whether the help is, talking therapy or some kind of, pharmacological assistance. Yeah, the important thing with any mental illness is that it not be a source of shame.
Being able to talk about it without that sense of shame, like, it's so important, isn't it?
Oh, it's hugely helpful to talk about it because, as soon as you talk about things or write them down or both, it stops being a frightening, scary monster that can sort of see but can't quite see all of, and it's going to attack you in ways you can't begin to understand or predict or fight against. And it becomes something like, oh, I've got these feelings, how do I deal with them? I mean, the problem with depression is that one of the major symptoms of it is the very thing that stops you from being able to get help. You know, you can't even pick up the phone to make a call. That's part of depression. And for people who don't know about it, haven't suffered it, haven't studied it, or don't have anyone in their lives that's given them direct experience of it, from a distance it can look like that person is simply refusing to, get on with their lives or pull up their socks and get on with things. They don't realise that that person can't.
It is a book that resonated with many people. In 2007, this was 9 years after $3 was published, the State Library of Victoria invited readers to vote for their all-time favourite novel set in Victoria, and $3 won, garnering around 40% of the votes. Like, It is speaking to people, and people are feeling less alone because of the book and seeing themselves in these experiences. How amazing is that?
I really hope that, as I said, I don't know that it can change a single vote, but I do hope that it makes people feel less alone. Mm-hmm. That's about the most you can hope for any book, really.
And that's really the power, as I keep saying, of literature and to keep chipping away and not be silent. I think that's so important as well. And look, thank you so much again for your time, Elliot. I think if I speak to you again about your third book, I'll almost have to call you a co-host.
Well, we've done Kat Finkel, which was a lot of fun. And now $3. It's a lot of fun.
And I won't let you get away with not talking to me about your new book.
I should hope not.
I'll be plaguing you.
I look forward to talking to you about that.
But thank you again so much.
Thank you, Danny. It's really my pleasure.